we're discussing our country's debate over the role of guns and gun laws here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 20 months ago marked the largest gun sales month ever, with nearly 2.4 million guns sold, averaging nearly 80,000 sales a day. Days after the onset of the pandemic, U.S. manufacturers, they couldn't keep up with demand. And this data, courtesy of the gun executive, whose job it was to keep pushing up sales volume more than a quarter century as VP of sales for Kimber. And he'd seen these wild rides before, after gut-wrenching mass shootings, after the election of Democratic presidents. He's lived the cycles of a multi-billion dollar industry. What role do gun manufacturers have in responsible gun ownership? Is fear used to promote gun ownership? 800-642-1234. Ryan Bussey's new memoir is called Gunfight, My Battle Against the Industry That Radicalized America. He is a senior advisor with Giffords, an advocacy group that promotes responsible gun ownership. Ryan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. Great to be here, and this is something we need to talk about. It's important.
Let's start with your value system around guns. Your father would have been right at home with conservationists here in Wisconsin. He read Aldo Leopold. He took great pride in converting thousands of acres to native grassland on your Kansas ranch. What values did he instill in you about guns and about conservation?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that a lot of people have a hard time understanding why it is that guns play such a central role now in our culture. And it is because of the various sort of upbringings and cultural connections that you note. My father, you know, I worked very hard. My father worked very hard. My brother worked hard. We didn't have a lot of time for a lot of fun things on the ranch and farm that I grew up on. But when we did, many of them involved guns. We hunted together. We shot together. We talked about the guns that we would use. And so many of the best parts of the early parts of my life, of our lives, centered in and around guns. And that's because, and so when we think about the cultural connection to guns, it's important to note that unlike a hammer, which is a tool, and a gun is a tool, but guns are representative of something much larger in our culture. And when that happens, when they become sort of wrapped in our identity, then they can be used to do very powerful political things. And of course, that's part of the later story in my book.
You've owned and shot lots of guns through the years. It was your paycheck, but you also make the case that guns do not define your family, that nor do you view them as symbols of intimidation. But at the end of the day, they're guns. They are scary. They are dangerous. They kill. How do you hold those two realities? How do you reckon with that?
Well, I think like everything else in our country, responsibility has to balance rights and freedoms. And I fear that now we're living in a country where one of those is out of whack. I had a college professor once who told me that if you have a Statue of Liberty on one coast, you must have a Statue of Responsibility on the other coast. Well, obviously, we only have one, and I don't think our country is focusing enough on the responsibility side. So directly to your question about guns, yes, they're an extremely serious thing. When you put your hands around a gun or you go shooting, it's a right unlike other rights that we have, because the impacts of exercising that right could be so unbelievably serious. So yes, I shoot with my boys. I own guns. I went hunting yesterday. I hope to hunt with my boys this weekend. But it's always done with responsibility and safety at the fore. It has to be. That's the way I was brought up. And frankly, up until the last few years, that sort of responsibility was infused in the firearms industry and was infused in almost all gun owners across the country. But like a lot of our norms, I'm fearful that that has broken down in certain segments.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ryan Bussey, former firearms company executive. After leaving the gun industry last year, new memoir out is called Gunfight, My Battle Against the Industry That Radicalized America. You can join in. Are you a gun owner? What do you think about the current culture around guns? Join in at 800-642-1234. So you land your dream job in the mid-90s. You start working at the gun manufacturing company Kimber, really working at the ground level, working, you know, seeing this company form around you. Why did you want to work in the gun industry?
Well, For a kid who grew up hunting and fishing, like a lot of kids in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, that was something I loved to do, not unlike playing baseball. And so for me to get into the industry that was so closely associated with my childhood passions, and frankly, now my adult passions, was kind of a dream job. As with most jobs, once you get it, you realize that it's not all dream. But to be associated with those things, I used to joke that I'm just trying to figure out a way to get paid to hunt and fish, and this is as close as I can get. And I joked, but that was actually, you know, there was a fair amount of truth in that. And so I think there's a lot of kids across Wisconsin who probably feel that way. And so I did that. And of course, it was a lot more complex. It was crazy. There's a lot of crazy stories in the book. And then eventually I realized I was part of an industry that was far more serious and far more impactful to the country than just a dream job.
One of those crazy stories, perhaps you can put that in this category. One of your salespeople you hired had actually taken a bullet to see what it was like. And that was your icebreaker with this new employee, Daryl. Can you describe Daryl and employees like him in this love affair with guns?
Yeah, I joke that everybody, you know, in the book is darkly funny in places. I think Daryl is one of those characters. He had a world-class mullet, and I describe him as wearing aviator sunglasses and an Ozzy Osbourne t-shirt that was a size too small. All of those things are true. And I was forced to hire him by the owner of the company. But Daryl, like a lot of people, had a singular characteristic that all people early on in the gun industry in the late 90s and early 2000s had, and that is that they had a deep overriding devotion to the love of guns. It wasn't their CV or their resume, and it wasn't MBAs, and it wasn't this sort of button-down culture that you might guess, you know, overrode all sorts of gun companies. The point in the Daryl story, and he did, when I first discussed his experience with guns, he explained to me that he knew what 9mm were because he had volunteered to take one at his bulletproof vest as he was as a security guard at a mall in Reno. All of that absolutely true. It's not from a Netflix series. And it's these sorts of people across the country who eventually had a humongous impact on the politics and the culture of America. And it's because there were a small group of us at a few different gun companies who were just deeply, deeply devoted to the love of guns. That was the overriding, you know, sort of unifying characteristic.
Calling yourself a gun runner and pushing metal and you know, just dinging a little bell every time you were able to sell more guns.
Yeah. You know, it's easy. And I believed there certainly are different types of guns and different types of gun companies and different types of owners. Throughout the book, one of the things that becomes apparent is that the NRA and the forces that need to use guns and gun owners and that overriding culture that I talked about, you know, just a couple minutes ago, eventually we were told that all guns and all gun owners were exactly the same. There could be no distinction. So I worked hard to develop and grow a company and sorts of guns that we could be very proud of and that I still am proud of today. But eventually the NRA said, well, there's no difference between, you know, your grandfather's old bird shotgun and a new modern AR-15. You have to think of them exactly the same. We must stand together. We are a monolith. And that really started rubbing me the wrong way. But I think if readers or listeners want to understand, you know, an important distinction here is that not all the guns are the same and not all gun owners are the same.
Ryan Bussey, a firearms industry insider, having spent a career leading the sales force for Kimber, a small arms manufacturer known for its 1911 pistol. Are you a gun owner? How do you feel about gun culture in America? Do you see yourself fitting into it or an outsider looking in? What causes you to feel the way you do about guns? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ryan Bussey here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how our nation came to be divided over guns and where to go from here. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Former gun executive Ryan Bussey, for a quarter century, helped build a company around the 1911 pistol. That is Kimber. It was the same gun that had killed his father's and grandfather's best friends. He writes, by the end of his 27-year career in the industry, gun factories would multiply their capacities by as much as 500%. And by the time the NRA was nominating him as Industry Person of the Year, Kimber was approaching production rates of nearly 2,000 guns a day. Ryan Bussey's new book is called Gunfight. He's with us for the hour. We're going to look more closely at the NRA, and Nicole in Milwaukee is starting us off. Nicole, hi, go ahead.
Hey, pardon me. So I guess my comments are twofold. To start, I grew up in a family with firearms. I have a firearm at home. I love target practice and shooting. But I think that background checks and gun safety courses should be a standard procedure in getting firearms. My 11-year-old, who has a BB gun, has gone through a safety training before even getting a BB gun, because I think that it's absolutely essential. And while not all of my family is the same, my immediate family, my husband and I, we are not members of the NRA, and we don't support the NRA because we feel as though the politics of it don't support responsible gun ownership. And so for us, it's very concerning when we see the gun culture in America, because we feel as though the culture is irresponsible and absolutely contributes to the multiple tragedies that seem to be happening in increasing number.
Nicole, thank you. I want to get Ryan to be able to respond here. Go ahead.
Well, I think Nicole is exactly right. And Nicole represents a good patriotic gun owner who, in my opinion, is very pro-gun. And by that, I mean, it's not pro-gun to be anti-responsibility. The sort of rampant runaway gun culture, this sort of faux machismo thing that we have seen, armed men with high cap magazines and AR-15s storming capitals in Michigan and intimidating people, or Kentucky, or frankly, this case that the entire state of Wisconsin and the entire country is watching right now, this sort of empowering of eventual vigilante culture. There's nothing that's pro-gun about any of that. We're not going to have any rights if we don't balance them with responsibility. And so I think it's time for people like Nicole and responsible gun owners across the country everywhere to stop accepting this idea that just because we want to be responsible, we're for background checks, we're for training classes, we're for all the other myriad of responsible actions that have to do with guns. There's nothing that's anti-gun about that. And we need to stop allowing those sorts of labels to be placed upon us.
Why has the NRA really moved to paint gun control measures, any gun control measures, as wrong, as unpatriotic?
Well, I tell the story through the book. It didn't happen immediately. And sort of the through line of the book is that the current national division that we deal with now, this schism, this unbelievable, you know, ugly chasm that we're going to probably experience over Thanksgiving dinner tables and in our workplaces, and where, you know, everything is 100% or 0%, or we hate people or we love people, like there are no options. That was a system that was developed by the NRA 15, 18 years ago, maybe starting right after Columbine, with some of the tapes that have come out. We've seen it's a very conscious thing. But the NRA stumbled onto the idea that if they could use fear and conspiracy and the never say no, 100% with us or against us sort of politics, they could ratchet up the nation's politics and the gun politics right up to just right at the boiling point. And so the NRA can never say no. They can never negotiate. They have to find ever more rampant conspiracy theories or, you know, ways to drum up hatred to keep the politics at just a fever pitch. And if that sounds like our current national politics, frankly, some of the politics, state politics in Wisconsin, well, it is. That's exactly what it is.
Paint a picture for us of Wayne LaPierre, the leader of the NRA, and his role in gun culture as what we're seeing it.
I met Wayne many times, have never been a fan. You'll probably get that from the book. But Wayne was a useful tool for the NRA and for some of the large marketing forces and political forces behind the scenes. Wayne bought into the idea that we could never say no, and that we could use every single tragedy, again, to you know, up the pressure in this national sort of political pressure cooker that we all live in now. I think that his impact, perhaps accidental to begin with, you know, I saw him many times jump up on a stage and say things like Barack Obama is going to rewrite the Constitution, almost as if he was throwing a trial balloon into the audience, you know. And then as crazy and conspiratorial and as unhinged as that sounds, the thousands of people in the audience would cheer. Mm. And I think they kind of looked around like, oh, wow, we have a live one. Let's keep going with this conspiracy theory. So again, very predictive of what we have in our nation. When QAnon popped up with crazy sex slave stories and pizza parlors and all sorts of other unhinged things, it really didn't surprise me. I had seen it for 10 or 15 years with the NRA and the crazy stuff that LaPierre would say.
You described your booth at NRA conventions as a sort of cross between a ski lodge and a Tiffany store. And instead of diamonds and blue boxes, you had guns. What were these conventions like? Because LaPierre was the centerpiece.
Yeah, the NRA conventions, they shifted over time. Probably 20 years ago or so, they were still a much healthier sort of camaraderie, kind of your father's or grandfather's NRA. And I tell the story, my grandfather was a proud FDR Republican, was in the military during World War II, went through the dirty 30s, you know, new hardship. And to him, his favorite hat was his NRA hat. And he wore it to my basketball and baseball games as, you know, that was his going out in public hat. And it represented camaraderie, safety, all, you know, patriotism, all the sorts of things that the NRA used to represent. And even through the early parts of my childhood, the NRA represented those things. My father, until he disavowed his NRA membership, you know, we got the NRA magazines in our house, and these magazines didn't lead with the impending doom of the Republic or how, you know, Hillary Clinton was the worst person on the face of the earth. None of that was in there. It was shooting competitions and old West guns and what new thing might you go hunting with, like very healthy slices of Americana, again, like across much of Wisconsin. But today I hate to say it, but it bears a strong resemblance to what you saw on January 6th, those sorts of overt guns mixed with very toxic politics, talking about very violent things.
Ryan Bussey, former firearms executive, new memoir is called Gunfight. Let's take another call now. Gary joining us from Ripon. Hi, Gary. What would you like to ask?
Well, I don't mean to imply an answer to this question, and I would agree that perhaps gun manufacturers are a special case. But do you feel that any business has any responsibility other than to continually increase sales and continually increase profits?
Yes, I do. I think that every business has a responsibility to be a decent citizen, just like every citizen has a responsibility to be a decent citizen. And, you know, the industry in which I worked didn't make marshmallows. It didn't make toilet paper. It didn't make lug nuts for automobiles. It made something as important as some people may feel that all of those things are. I'm sorry, but guns are much more impactful to our society. And so do I think that an extra level of responsibility should be laid upon an industry and a people that embark on making and selling and marketing firearms into a democratic society? I absolutely do, because the potential impacts are potentially so much more serious. Again, when we have a 17-year-old drive from Illinois, enter the state of Wisconsin, what makes him more impactful that evening? It's the gun that he grabbed. It's not the shoes that he wore. It's not the jeans that he wore. It's not the cap that he wore. It's the gun that he grabbed. So if we want to be responsible citizens in a democracy, we'll realize that, and we will either be a part of the problem or we'll be a part of the solution. And I think it's time that we be a part of the solution.
I want to further what Gary was asking there, because cities went after big tobacco with massive settlements, and the gun industry was really fearful it would be faced with massive compensation payments to governments for the violent impact of guns. But that didn't come to pass. What happened?
Yeah, you're probably referencing there, Kate. In the late 90s and early 2000s, the federal government attempted to, and many municipal governments across the country, including the largest cities, Miami, Chicago, all across the country, tried to duplicate the tobacco lawsuits and impose those upon the firearms industry so that the impacts of firearms violence could be, so that the firearms industry could be held financially liable for those things. Eventually, what happened was the Bush administration came into power and George Bush signed what was called PLACA, the Protection and Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which was essentially a liability shield that kept any of those liabilities and lawsuits from being imposed over the top of the firearms industry.
The book is called Gunfight. We'll pick this up with Ryan Bussey after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing gun culture in America on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Former firearms industry sales executive Ryan Bussey states in his new memoir that he regrets that he helped the NRA create a political world where debate can no longer happen. He writes, "The NRA fomented a hardline, you're with us or against us position that left no room for common sense." What is your view of the NRA? Join in. Ryan Bussey's book is called Gunfight. He's with us for the hour. Let's bring on another caller now. Michael is joining us from Milwaukee, a veteran of the Vietnam War. Michael, hi.
Hi, good morning. As I said to your screener, I've been a gun owner ever since I was 16 years old, actually earlier than 16. We started to get BB guns when we were 12 and that stuff like that. Then I got my first handgun when I was 16. I'm 75 years old. Owned guns my whole life, but you know what? It was a different world back there. The world we live in today is not what I grew up in or what even was around 20, 30 years ago. It's changed dramatically. That being said, as far as the NRA goes, the NRA doesn't really care about guns, has nothing to do with guns. All it has to do with is politics and money. It's all money. Everything that's going on today is just all about money and politics. And on the topic of the weapons that we have today, the AR-15, which was designed with one purpose in mind, is to kill people. It's the only reason it was created. It's a beautiful design weapon just for one purpose, not for animals, but just killing people. And there's no reason that that gun should be owned or carried out in the public by American citizens. It should be basically a military weapon. Period.
Michael, I want to get Ryan to jump in here. And the AR-15 is eventually renamed and rebranded as a modern sporting rifle. Ryan, go ahead.
I think, Michael, thank you for calling. You make a couple points in there. And the first one, I think perhaps all NRA members and gun owners across Wisconsin and all of our listeners should absorb. It's a very good one. And that is that the NRA is a culture war organization. It's not a gun owners organization. It is an organization that figured out that the culture of guns that you grew up with, Michael, that I grew up with, something that is very important to us culturally, that's part of our identity, can be used and twisted to then make us vote against our own self-interest, to make us act against our own self-interest, to make us, frankly, I saw good people allow incredibly important principles in their lives be gobbled up. Environmental and conservation advocacy, of which I'm extremely ardently in support of. But then eventually, even, 11 months ago, we saw thousands, perhaps millions of people willing to see our democracy gobbled up. And remember, there were two types of flags at the January 6th insurrection. There were Trump MAGA American flags, the political flags. But then the other type were there were come and take it AR-15 flags. So the AR-15 and guns are right at the center of our national political radicalization. They have been used by the NRA to twist our lives and our culture into such a hateful fervor that people are now dreaming of, willing to kill their fellow citizens in some ugly civil war. I mean, I think this is what drove Kyle Rittenhouse. He believes he's going to be down there, go down there and be a part of a civil war. It's an ugly, ugly thing. We have to take this conversation back from the NRA.
What did you see in the changing the image of this assault rifle, and what has it done in terms of the marketing? Because you also see this huge surge in sales.
Yeah, it should be noted that a lot of people think that the AR-15 was outlawed during the what was called the assault weapons ban, which was in place from 1994 until September 13th, 2004, when Bush did not renew it. The AR-15 was never illegal during the assault weapons ban. You could still buy as many AR-15s as you want in that 10-year period. Assault weapon was defined as a gun that, as an AR-15 type gun and several others that had additional characteristics added onto the gun, features added onto the gun, and was and had a high capacity magazine. There were hardly any gun companies that bought or sold or marketed any AR-15s in that 10-year period, even though they were legal. Why? Because the industry and people and dealers and manufacturers knew that it was irresponsible to pump those into society. And there's lots of stories in the book about how that was known. Once that changed, once the lid was ripped off of that, once the NRA figured out that this politics of fear and division could drive voters, and then accidentally the same thing drove gun sales, and then we had a conflagration of returning war veterans from decades of war in Afghanistan and Iraq, it turned into this toxic soup of this faux machismo militarism, where now it's as if you can't be a red-blooded conservative American male if you don't have an AR-15 and aren't willing to go down to the local protest and confront high school kids or lawmakers with an AR-15. There's nothing patriotic about that. There's something very sick about it, but it's not patriotic. And to make sure that that stayed, you know, socially acceptable to people, the NRA and the NSSF, the trade group for the firearms industry, did a lot of studies and ended up renaming and rebranding the AR-15 as an MSR, modern sporting rifle. In other words, they appropriated the culture that I had grown up with and that so many Wisconsinites, I know your firearm season starts, your deer season starts this weekend. They appropriated that culture to then overlay an acceptance onto the AR-15 so that it could run rampant across the nation. Responsibility could be removed.
Manufacturers also even change the color of these ARs from black to a sandy color, representing more of what the military would have in the Middle East.
Yeah, the market segment is still referred to as black guns, right? And, and a lot of people have probably heard the term black rifle coffee. That's a right-wing coffee company that capitalizes on this new sort of machismo in and around this rifle. So AR-15s were always just a flat black thing because, as Michael noted, they were a tool for war. They weren't fancy or adorned or collector's items. They were a simple tool, like a shovel or a hammer or anything else. They were a tool for a very specific purpose. As they became very culturally intertwined, then they became adorned. Then the firearms industry referred to the wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan as the sandbox, the quote unquote sandbox. Well, the color of the sandbox, meaning desert tan, was applied to these guns and many others to put a military twinge on all the millions of guns that were sold and marketed to civilians.
Ryan Bussey with us. The new book is Gunfight. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jack is joining us from Madison with a question. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hi there. So a couple of comments. First of all, I didn't really grow up around guns myself, even though my dad was in the Army. I never saw any combat time. It was good, but he was around it. So I didn't really grow up shooting until just a couple of years ago when I went with my cousin to the gun range in Eagan, Minnesota. So there's a lot I don't know about guns, even though I am fascinated by it. My question for Ryan was, I guess, given your ties, I mean, you're not with the NRA, but when you met with them or spoke with them, I guess, how aware were you of their connections to, I guess, foreign governments' propaganda wings, case in point, Russia and the Kremlin, and their attempts to dissuade the American public or to, I guess, further intensify these culture wars that the NRA on its own had already been instilling? It's like, I guess, what might you be familiar with in the NRA's relationship with Russia and other foreign governments in their attempts to further divide Americans on the issues of guns.
Jack, thank you.
Yeah, Jack, I thankfully was never associated with any of those activities. What I did witness is once the NRA set a course where it had to increase the social angst in our country, the hate, the conspiracy theory, back to that old pressure cooker idea, right? It had to do whatever it could to fuel that pressure cooker. I did witness through the people I knew and through the conventions, and I tell some stories of this, that anything and everything could be sacrificed as fuel for that pressure cooker. The first thing that tipped me over the edge was that it was the environmentalism. You know, I fought for places where I hunt and fish, wild places, largely in the Western United States. I did a press conference in 2004 at the National Press Club. I stood up and I criticized the Bush administration, and then, you know, holy hell broke loose on me. So I saw that they would sacrifice wild places, even though they said they had been in support of them. But slowly over time, every single other thing could be sacrificed too, even patriotism. And in that 2013-14 range, I started to notice all sorts of Russian people, including Maria Butina, walking through the trade show and at the big industry trade events. She's a Russian spy, convicted Russian spy, by the way. Many people probably know that, but she used the NRA to infiltrate the Trump campaign, people on the edge of the Trump campaign in Republican politics. And my point there is that, you know, and then lots of industry executives were making trips to Russia to buy ammunition or to visit Russian oligarchs. And I thought, what won't you people sacrifice? It's wild places. It's our democracy. It's decency. It's responsibility. Like, everything becomes fodder for this big political machine. I did recognize that very, very apparently. It took me some years to see it as clearly as I see it now, but it also took years for them to hone it. They sort of stumbled into it.
Let's bring on Ben now in Green Bay. Ben, you're in your 20s. What do you see?
Hello. Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. I'm younger. I'm around 27, and I'm definitely a part of, as you would say, gun culture. And I just want to comment on what I kind of see as maybe like the younger generations and generations after me, kind of their conception of gun culture. I, along with many people that I know my age, actually were into guns, have very much a disdain for the NRA, because we just see them as a bloated bureaucracy that doesn't really do anything. And I know there seems to be a contention between what are jokingly referred to as FUDs, kind of the older crowd who believe they should only own break barrels and bolt actions. But I think that generally it's more of a hobby thing for most people our age. And I don't personally know that many people that take it so seriously that it would breach into the kind of extremist category. Hmm. But then again, at the same time, with any kind of hobby, if it was cars, if it was whatever, if, you know, people start, you know, the more eyebrow raising and the more people kind of try to, you know, for lack of better terms, take that away, I mean, there is going to be anger and resentment. But that, I don't know, I think that's something to consider.
Ben, thank you.
Hey, Ben, thanks for calling, and I appreciate your hobby, and I certainly have nothing against responsible shooting, target practice, you know, all of those things, as long as they're responsible activities. This is a bit of an aside, but I think it's important for the listeners to understand the way that people in Ben's sort of market segment, as spoken like a former firearms executive, how they might be modified, or not all people, but how some of them might be converted into the dangerous sort of 1% customer. And here's an example. For years before PLCA was passed, that Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act was passed, firearms companies were very responsible with how they named and marketed guns, or much more responsible than they are now. For instance, guns were named like the Smith & Wesson 629 or the Remington 700 or the Kimber Custom Classic. Why? Because attorneys knew that you didn't do things or market things or name things in a way that might incite people to go do irresponsible things. In other words, let's make sure that we advertise guns for the way Ben wants to use them. Target practice, having fun, doing responsible things. Today, we have, there's all kinds of examples of marketing campaigns. I'll give you a couple. We have a gun that's marketed and named and a lot of money spent on the marketing campaign that's called the Wilson Arms Urban Super Sniper. Hmm. Okay. It's not a 700. It's not a 629. It's not a custom classic. It's an ultimate. It's an ultimate that we also have the ultimate arms warmonger. So we have a warmonger and an urban super sniper as marketing campaigns. Now, I don't expect that Ben is going to do something irresponsible, but advertising is used because advertising works. So what do you think somebody who buys the Wilson Arms Urban Super Sniper might wish to do with it? Perhaps be an urban super sniper? Well, that's what the gun's called. So my point here is that responsibility has left the building. Ben's not going to have any rights if we allow this thing on this graph to keep going the way it is, because there is a certain portion of gun owners who are wishing for a civil war. They want to use their urban super sniper.
Ryan Bussey's new memoir, A Journey Through His Evolution in Thinking, How He Came to Distrust the Firearms Industry, which was once his everything, the center of his livelihood for so long, eventually quit the gun industry. We'll talk more. The memoir is called Gunfight. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with former gun industry executive Ryan Bussey. He left the gun industry last year after a career leading Kimber's sales force and spending his career, as they call it, pushing metal. He writes that despite the more than 500 companies that produce a version of the AR-15, last year's sales levels were nearly 6 million units higher than the highest mark of the Obama years. We'll look for solutions here. Bussey's memoir is called Gunfight. He's with us for about 7 more minutes. I want to bring up smart guns, and I found this really interesting. You said the NRA stifled the innovation of the smart gun that many in the industry knew was viable technology, meaning it could save lives. So what is smart gun technology, and what is the NRA's fear of a tech advancement here?
Smart guns are a somewhat nebulous term, but the idea is that the gun can be modified, or essentially electronic security devices can be placed in the gun that allow only the owner of the gun to fire the gun. So, you know, for instance, if the gun is left around and a child inadvertently picks the thing up, they couldn't fire the gun, hurt or injure or kill anybody. The NRA and then all firearms companies ended up fighting that sort of technology, not because it was effective or ineffective, but because it could make the guns more expensive and could slow down sales. In any other industry, that sort of technical advancement would be sort of the holy grail of how do we look forward and make advancements in firearms.
Because big tech lives and breathes these disruptions. That would revolutionize. That would make a lot of money.
You would think it would, but culturally it's very important. Nothing, you know, actually, what ended up happening is guns have become more simple and to a large degree less safe, because many of the firearms out there, one of the attributes is they have to be able to be deployed very, very quickly with almost no safety. For instance, a Glock has what's called the trigger safety on it, and a Glock, one of the most prevalent firearms in America, the only safety on it is a small button on the trigger, which means when you put your finger on the trigger and pull it, it's going to go bang. That's literally the only safety on the gun.
What are some solutions here? I know you've advocated for more stringent background checks. What would change what's going on here?
Well, I think there's a couple legislative. First off, it should be noted that there's no perfect solution. When you live in a democracy, in a society like this, we're not going to completely do away with gun violence. We have rights. We have Second Amendment rights. We have First Amendment rights. And so the idea that we're going to find a perfect solution one way or another, that's just silly talk. That's not going to exist. So what we should do as responsible citizens is seek out ways that make our existence and our society and our democracy better. There's a couple legislative things that I think we could implement. One, universal background checks. That's certainly one of them. We should make sure it's in everybody's best interest, especially gun owners who want to maintain our rights and do the responsible thing, to make sure that only responsible people and qualified people have and own guns. Secondarily, I am becoming increasingly alarmed with this open carry, intimidation, vigilante craziness that we're dealing with across the country. A civil society cannot exist when one party is standing over the other with a gun. And we've seen far too much of that, especially in the last 18 to 24 months. This is a cultural problem. I'm not talking about banning the guns. I don't mean that, you know, Ben that called who wants to own his guns and use his guns and shoot at the range. I'm completely fine with that. But this irresponsible behavior of taking them into the general public and scaring people, you know, the book opens with my young son, who at the time was 75 pounds soaking wet, intimidated by one of these armed, quote unquote, Second Amendment patriots at a Black Lives Matter rally. The guy started screaming at him and the guy had a gun on his hip. And that's like matches over gasoline. Something is going to explode. It did explode in Kenosha, but it could explode far worse than this. So we need either state laws or national laws to outlaw open carry and especially intimidation with firearms. Then the last thing I'll say culturally is that responsible gun owners, like several of the callers who called in today, need to stand up and say, these people do not represent us. We are gun owners, but we're not those kind of gun owners. We're not voting with the NRA. We're willing to vote our own self-interest. We are responsible. We cannot let these people continue to take the mic in the room. Again, very much, this is very similar to our politics, right? Where an extreme on one side has taken the mic and they have set the course for the country. We as gun owners must say, no, we are willing to split off from you. We are not the same as you. You do not represent us.
But advancing policy, you need the data and the research. Is there solid record keeping for actual gun sales in America? How reliable are the numbers that we see in the FBI's background check system?
So they're generally reliable. You may be getting at a disturbing trend called ghost guns, which allow a subversion of that data. And ghost guns are a way to get around the technical reporting requirements of manufactured guns. So a gun is made, let's just, for all intents and purposes, I'll say it's about 95% complete, but it's not 100% complete, so can't quite be called a gun. So you buy these parts, drill a couple holes in it, then all of a sudden it becomes a gun. You assemble it, and you have a gun without a serial number. And then it is not reported anywhere. And this is not just something that's happening, you know, a couple times a day across the country. It's now happening thousands of times a day across the country. So we have this proliferation of unreported guns without serial numbers. It's a very dangerous thing.
We only have a few seconds left. How have you changed since writing this memoir?
I don't know that I've changed, except for that I've finally, you know, the shackles are off. I've been able to speak my truth. I've been able to tell this story. I think it's an important story. I fought while I was inside the industry to make these changes and for responsibility. Now that I'm gone, the police state of that industry no longer applies to me, and I can tell the truth of my life and my family's life and the country's evolution in this book. And it's, you know, it's frightening, it's empowering, but I think it's important, and I hope folks read the book.
Ryan, thank you for joining us. Ryan Bussey is the author of Gunfight, My Battle Against the Industry That Radicalized America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.